began a five-part series called Rediscovering the Ancient Ways of Christianity. The first three parts are online. In the first one, we talked about community, loneliness, life transitions, and feasting. We reviewed how, in that first week, how one of the keys of Christianity is a sacramental worldview. And that includes mechanisms for fostering reconciliation among people who disagree. It includes dealing with issues of forgiveness. It includes rituals for life transitions, births, deaths, marriages, coming of age, etc. And these were all things that the author of this book, called Religion for Atheists, looks at wistfully and says, wow, this is really neat. I wish we had this. But he's an atheist. They don't have it. So what do you do? In the second week, we reflected with him about how authentic religion fosters authentic goodness and kindness in people when it's practiced authentically. We noted, for instance, the value of religion as a motivator, as opposed to kind of a legal moralism. The idea that it's not, you know, some people say this, you can't legislate morality. Well, of course, every law has a moral basis. But ultimately, some things are better left to persuasion. And he used the image of a star chart. Like, you know, how do you motivate kids? You don't just tell them what they can't do. You give them stars when they do good things. He says, religions kind of get this idea. And there's all kinds of things we do, as Christians even, that motivate us to do the right thing. Included in these sort of ideas that are celebrated and rewarded and praised in our tradition would be, of course, strategies for forgiving people, the tradition of being slow to anger, daring to imagine how we might help someone else might feel, sort of taking on their perspective, devices, of course, mechanisms for seeing, putting our drama in perspective, right? Not seeing my own life's challenges as totally unique or insurmountable. And one of the ideas he really explored in several chapters was the idea of original sin being a useful notion, that if we realize that mankind has flaws, when we encounter our own flaws, we can be merciful toward them. And when we encounter flaws in other people, we can be merciful to them too, because we don't expect to be perfect. We know they're going to be a little broken. We know we're going to have flaws. And so rather than give up, we confront our flaws and we move on. Christianity is built, I mean, our faith is built on this idea of God's mercy and our brokenness. And yet God calls us to move, not to stay there fully, but to move through it and beyond it. But even as we move, we're going to trip and have challenges that face us. And oftentimes the secular approach presupposes that mankind is really jolly good. Everyone's happy, we're all fine. And if we're not happy all the time, then we have a psychological problem. And we need to get, you know, et cetera.
Or we need to be educated.
Take pills. I mean, and there's a place, I would submit there's a place for that, but there's also a way in which we've gone overboard, too. So, anyway, tonight we talked last week about education, Brian, actually. So that tied in with these themes.
The point is education by itself isn't enough.
Exactly. Well, because the Orthodox would say it has to be formation. And even then, formation won't do so much. Well, let's move on here to some themes for this coming week, for this week. The theme that Debutun introduces midway through his book is the theme of tenderness, the need that all of us have for tenderness. I'm going to read some paragraphs here about the idea of tenderness. A 15th century chapel in a back street of an unnamed northern European town. It is early afternoon on a somber winter's day, and a middle-aged man shakes down his umbrella and steps inside. The space is warm and dark, lit only by several rows of candles that throw a dance of shadows across the limestone walls. There are comfortable, well-worn pews, and on the floor, people are praying. An elderly woman kneels in the far corner, mumbling to herself with eyes closed. The man who's walked in is exhausted, his joints ache. He feels weak. He's vulnerable and close to tears. No single event has brought him to this point. Just a run of minor humiliations that have culminated in an overwhelming sense of his own mediocrity and self-hatred. His career, once so promising, has for a long time now been in a sin. He knows how unimpressive he must be to others, how keen they are to move on from him in social gatherings, and just how many of his proposals and letters have gone unanswered. He no longer has the confidence to push himself forward. He's appalled by the scenes of impatience and vanity in his character, which have led him to this professional impasse. He is stricken by feelings of remorse, foreboding, and loneliness. He knows, however, that he couldn't possibly bring these worries home with him. His sons need him to believe, need to believe he's strong. His harried wife has too much on her plate already. He has learned from experience how badly things turn when he presents himself to the household like this. He wants to fall asleep. He wants to be held. He wants to cry. He wants to be forgiven and reassured. Having fallen to his knees in the chapel, he looks up at the painting that hangs over the altar. It shows a tender, sympathetic, gentle young woman with a halo around her head. She gazes back down at him with infinite care, and without his having to say a word, she seems to understand everything. He remembers the prayers learned so long ago as a child, when he still thought about the full potential he had, when he knew how to make others proud of him, when his parents worried how much he had to eat and wipe his fingers for him after a meal, when the world with all its opportunities lay before him. He remembered, "Hail Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now in the hour of our death." And he closes his eyes, and he feels the press of tears against his eyelids. To you I come, before you I stand, sorrow and sinful, O Mother of God. Despise not my prayers, but in your compassions hear me. We sang that tonight, actually, which is kind of ironic. We sang, it's a Latin version of Beneath Thy Compassion, which, by the way, that hymn, Beneath Thy Compassion, we found inscriptions several years ago in the catacombs that are from the 2nd century. That hymn we sang tonight is not a newfangled, it's old, and it's ancient both in the East and the West. So, but what he's describing here is a basic human need to be comforted, to receive this kind of tenderness. When I first encountered Orthodoxy, both in two forms, I went to a Greek church in Gainesville. It was very Greek-American. And then I went to Russia. And in both places, I was struck by the major role that the Virgin plays in piety. In the Greek church I was at, it was Holy Week. And it was my first night there, it was at a Kathos Friday and Saturday, the fifth week of Lent. And there were all these prayers to the Virgin Mary. And in the middle of the Kathos is the line, "O holy heifer." I remember, laughing at this line. You know, what does this mean? But I was struck by this Virgin Mary being the center of so much energy and piety. And I saw people who were grown weep. And it was just part of what they did. And it took me, of course, a while to kind of enter this myself. But eventually in Orthodoxy, I don't think there's a point where you kind of intellectually work that out. You just, if you come and you kind of begin to believe a little bit, over time, your heart kind of gets converted by it. And you wake up one day and you realize, oh, I love her so much. It doesn't happen overnight. But this is part of our experience. So this man here, though he doesn't believe in God, he understands the human aspect as to why the Virgin means so much to us. So he writes this. In the broadest sense, the cult of Mary speaks, and by the way, the word cult doesn't cause any problems. The veneration, the regard for Mary, the cult of Mary, liturgically even, speaks of the extent to which, despite our adult powers of reasoning, our responsibilities and our status, the needs of childhood endure within all of us. While for long stretches of our lives we can believe in our maturity, we never succeed in insulating ourselves against the kind of catastrophic events that sweep away our ability to reason, that sweep away our courage and our resourcefulness. Anything like that can put us into a primordial state of helplessness, he says. At such moments, we may long to be held and reassured, as we were decades ago by some sympathetic adult, most likely our mother, a person who made us feel physically protected, who stroked our hair, who looked at us with benevolence and tenderness, and perhaps said not very much, other than very quietly, "Of course." He gets this. And this is just sometimes there's nothing to say. There's nothing to be heard, except we go before God, we go before the saints, especially Theotokos, and we're comforted. One of the most beautiful prayers is to go and just stand before the icons and to or fall down before them, especially her, and just weep. This is a prayer. And our faith really gets that. And imagine, where would you go if you didn't have this vision of faith? Where would you go for this kind of experience? So Adipaton points out the similarities between the fit figures of the Virgin Mary. He even notes how they're like the ancient female kind of goddesses in the Mediterranean, Asian goddesses of consolation. For him, it points out the human need. For us, we'd say these are images of the same compassion of God and the Virgin Mary throughout all cultures. That doesn't cause us any problems with our faith, right? We would see, who was it? Metropolitan George Koder of Lebanon said the job of Christians is to recognize the spirit of Christ sleeping in every people and to call that spirit to consciousness. Isn't that great? Isn't that a great vision of mission work? To call the sleeping consciousness of all peoples back to awareness of God, wake them up. You know? It's a different image than just kind of throwing the Bible at them. So, the Virgin Mary connects us with our most vulnerable, even childlike part of our hearts. An atheist might try to repress this instinct, which could be really unfortunate and very dangerous, just in terms of human beings being healthy. He says this, by contrast with religion, atheism is prone to seem coldly impatient with our neediness. The ranging for comfort which lies at the heart of Marian devotion seems perilously regressive and at odds with the rational engagement with existence on which atheists so pride themselves. Mary, and those like her, have been framed as symptoms of urges which adults ought quickly to outgrow. At its most withering and ignatiously pugnacious, atheism has attacked religion for blinding itself to its own motives, for being unwilling to acknowledge that at its base, nothing more than a glorified response to childhood longing, which had been dressed up, recast in new forms, and projected into the heavens. This charge may well be correct, he says. We don't believe that, but he does, perhaps. The problem is that those who level it are themselves often involved in denial, a denial of the needs of childhood. In their zeal to attack believers whose frailties have led them to embrace the supernatural, atheists may neglect the frailty that is an inevitable feature of all of our lives. That's part of human existence, to be frail, to have needs, and to seek to have them met in relationship with other people, with each other, with a mother, with God, with the Virgin Mary. This is part of our experience as human beings, as hopefully people who are trying to be healthy and integrated. He writes this, Christianity describes the capacity to accept dependence as a mark of moral and spiritual health. You hear that? Christianity describes the capacity to accept dependence as a mark of moral and spiritual health. Only the proud and the vainglorious would attempt to deny their weaknesses, while the devout can declare without awkwardness, as a sign of their faith, that they have spent time and tears at the foot of a statue of a giant wooden mother. The cult of Mary recasts vulnerability as a virtue and thus corrects our habitual tendency to believe in a conclusive division between adulthood and childhood. At the same time, Christianity is appropriately delicate in the way it frames our needs. It allows us to partake of the comfort of the maternal without forcing us to face up to our lingering and inescapable desire for an actual other. So it's a beautiful vision, right? But that line, you know, it is a healthy thing for Christians if we can acknowledge our dependence, right? It's spiritually and morally healthy for us to do that. And I would say as a priest, that's really an essential part of when I see people growing, they're usually making steps in that direction, you know. I can't do this by myself. I can't be an island by myself. I have to have support. I have to have others in my life. I have to have God. If we can't do that, then something's not quite right in our life, I would say. So, Are there any thoughts about tenderness and this kind of idea of the Virgin Mary as an icon of tenderness? Thoughts?
I don't think, I mean, the way we see back home Virgin Mary is not necessarily, you know, like a child looking to the mother. It's not necessarily, I mean, it's tenderness, but it's more like the protector.
Uh-huh.
This is the way we see.
Yeah.
All right. You know, every mother tells her child she's watching over you.
Yes.
It's more the idea of protecting the ones that suffer, that go through a lot of, you know, turmoil. I don't see that as something that we should suppress in us because this is the child in you.
Oh, I don't think that at all.
I don't get that necessarily.
Huh. Huh. Well, I think that his point would be the fact that one would even seek protection is almost a childlike act. For someone to go to the Virgin Mary and light a candle and say, "Oh, Virgin Mother, protect us, help us," that act alone is one that.
See, that for me, I mean, to think that you'll never need help and you're always going to be...
That's just how orthodox you are.
I mean...
I think you're actually arguing, you're actually kind of supporting what he's saying. Because for you, it's just self-evident.
Right, but from his point of view as an atheist, if you think that, you know, light will never strike you or something, it just...
To go light a candle and do that and ask the Virgin Mary to help would be a really...
At the same time, thousands of them did that when something really bad happened. Everybody, you know, everybody goes and prays, and they don't know to whom.
But what do they say? There's no atheists in foxholes, right? You remember that line? Yeah.
But that's the way we see, you know, the Virgin.
Protector of your households. And, okay. He also has a good word, I think, about one of the blessings of faith. Is it allows ourselves to be pessimistic. So, De Botton quotes Enlightenment philosopher Blaise Pascal. He was noted for making many depressing comments. He was a Christian of some sort. He was a Roman Catholic. He said, here are two of his quotes. "If our condition were truly happy, we should not need to divert ourselves from thinking about it so much." So, he's pointing out that most of us aren't very happy. He also says, "Man's greatness comes from knowing he is wretched." You know, so you hear these kinds of things from Pascal, and one could say, well, this is really depressing, and what kind of religion is this? If you read our prayers in Orthodoxy, you know, woe to me, wretched sinner, there's a lot of pessimism in these prayers. But he says this, "We are usually cast into gloom, not so much by negativity as by hope. It is hope with regard to our careers, our love lives, our children, our politicians, and our planet, that is primarily to blame for angering us and embittering us. The incompatibility between the grandeur of our aspirations and the mean reality of our condition generates the violent disappointments which rack our days and etch themselves in lines of acrimony across our faces. Hence the relief which can explode in a burst of laughter when we finally come across an author generous enough to confirm that our various worst insights, far from being unique and shameful, are part of the common, inevitable reality of mankind. Our dread that we might be the only ones to feel anxious or bored or jealous, cruel, perverse, or narcissistic turns out to be gloriously unfounded, opening up unexpected opportunities for communion around our dark realities. We should honor Pascal," you know, this negative sort of vision, he says, "and the long line of Christian pessimists to which he belongs, for doing us the incalculably great favor publicly and elegantly rehearsing the facts of our sinful state." And, you know, there's an example of this that comes to mind. One of the challenges I knew about in Russia with priests was in the villages, the priests could live pretty simply and have very simple salaries because everyone else was simple. If you gave him the same livelihood in the city, even adjusted for higher cost of apartments, morale in the clergy went way down. Because next, everyone around them, they were living in total poverty. And so what kicks in, just basic human kind of, you look at everyone around you to gauge what my expectations should be. And if everyone is living this kind of life around me, it's very depressing sometimes. And so, if we're living very simply in the country, and we're not, we're not perhaps plugged into all the media stuff that's always encouraging us to buy, we can be rather content and rather in very simple settings. This is why in our country there's a rule, and of course our parish does this just fine, but there's a rule that the priest should make the salary of the people in the area. Right? You shouldn't be poorer or richer than the average. You should be kind of average, so that jealousy doesn't, the expectations he has and that the people have of him. Because what if I had a Mercedes, if I had the nicest car, if I had, the nicest house, that'd be a temptation for you guys, right? Because that's kind of odd, I think. Our expectations are very important for how joyful we can be, how realistic our life is. The gospel, so to speak, of someone like Pascal or our church fathers even, contrasts starkly with most modern visions of progress. One of my favorite shows, I have to confess it still is Star Trek. I love Star Trek as a child. And in Star Trek, there's this vision of endless progress, right? Everything's getting better and more advanced every generation, right? If any of you have ever watched it, there's a timeline of things that happen. And mankind develops, and then there's these leaps forward, and he develops warp drive engines, and then there's all this artificial gravity and transporter devices, and on and on and on into the future. And with that kind of vision, I was reading an article about kids nowadays are actually kind of depressed about space because the expectations have gotten so far out there about what we could do. I mean, they see things on TV that are astounding, and we can barely go to the moon again. We're talking about maybe going to Mars, but they've read about, colonizing planets and other galaxies. So how, it's just this kind of this vision that's very different. So when our expectations get too far in front, it causes some problems in our lives. And Thibautin says this: "This is not a stance for which the modern world betrays much sympathy. For one of the world's dominant characteristics, and certainly its greatest flaw, is perhaps optimism. Despite occasional moments of panic, most often connected with market crises or wars or pandemics, the secular age maintains an all but irrational devotion to the narrative of improvement based upon a messianic faith in the three great drivers of change, that is science, technology, and commerce. Material improvements since the mid-18th century have been so remarkable and have so increased our comfort, our safety, wealth, and power as to deal an almost fatal blow to our capacity to see the pessimistic, and therefore, crucially, to our ability to stay sane and content. It has been impossible to hold on to a balanced assessment of what life is likely to provide us when we have witnessed the cracking of the genetic code, the invention of the mobile phone, the opening of Western-style supermarkets in remote corners of China, and the launch of the Hubble telescope. Yet while it's undeniable the scientific and economic trajectories of mankind have been pointed firmly upwards, we do not comprise mankind, we personally. None of us as individuals can dwell exclusively amid the groundbreaking developments of genetics and telecommunications that lend our age its distinctive and buoyant prejudices. We may derive some benefit from the availability of hot baths and computer chips, but our lives are no less subject to accident, frustrated ambitions, heartbreaks, jealousies, anxiety or death than were those of our medieval forebears." So his point is, the basic stuff of our life is not all that different from the way it was a long time ago. But what we see is all this promise and expectation and, Star Trek and space travel, all these things that make our life better, theoretically. But we're still stuck with the reality of human life. Death and children getting sick and people being depressed, etc. And Christianity encourages us to be brutally honest about our current situation. In the book of Revelation, the Lord laments those who think they are rich and satisfied, when in fact they are poor and blind. He encourages people to recognize that they're poor and they're blind, that they're sick and they're lame. And he says in the gospel, Jesus says, I don't come to save the righteous, people that think everything is fine, that think their lives are going on perfectly. I come to save the sinners, people that can see what's going on in their lives without the rose-colored glasses. That's the gospel. That's what Jesus teaches. And so the realism here isn't negativity. The realism is something much, much more important. Christianity is not, he writes, an unhopeful institution. It merely has the good sense to locate its expectations firmly in the next life, in the moral and material perfection of a world far different from this one. We would say as Christians, he's looking at it from the outside, we would say not only is the next life, but even in this life, you read about the saints, they had this joy in this life that was not dependent upon living with a lot of power or money or stuff, but they had joy in the gulag, or they had joy in their simple jobs or in their monasteries. They found it even now. This relegation of hope to another sphere, other than the material sphere, has enabled the church to be uniquely clear-eyed and unsentimental about this earthly reality. It does not assume that politics could ever create perfect justice, that any marriage could be free of conflict or dissent, that money could ever deliver perfect security, that a friend could be unfailingly loyal, or more generally, that heavenly Jerusalem could be built here on this earth right now. Since its founding, Christianity has maintained a usefully sober view of life, a kind that the secular world has been too sentimental and cowardly to embrace, about our chances of improving on the brute facts of our corrupted nature. Isn't that interesting? Right? Think about, and Father Alexander Schmemann is one of the great kind of church leaders of the last generation. He was very much opposed to the kind of liberation theology. Are you familiar with liberation theology in South America, where the Jesuits would join the Marxist guerrillas to overthrow the government and, you know, bring in New Jerusalem? The problem with that is it's a distraction, because it doesn't really work. I mean, not that we should bury our heads in the sand and not work politically, have views that we take seriously. I think we should. But that doesn't change the fundamental realities of what's going on here or in our lives. So the secular, he says, are at this moment in history a great deal more optimistic than religious people are. Something of an irony, given the frequency with which the latter have been derided by the former for their naivete. It is the secular whose longing for perfection has grown so intense as to lead them to imagine that paradise might be realized on this earth after just a few more years of financial growth and medical research, with no evident awareness of the contradiction they may, in the same breath, roughly dismiss a belief in angels, while sincerely believing the combined powers of the International Monetary Fund and the medical research establishment, Silicon Valley, and democratic politics could together cure all the ills of mankind. It's a millenarian view. It's a faith that these things, these bits and pieces of progress, could save us. And he says we should cease then to view the pessimism of religion, of our faith, as belonging to them alone. We should strive to adopt, it is the ambitious and the driven among us who are the most sorely in need of having our reckless hopes dampened through immersive dousings in the darkness of religion. This is particularly priority for secular Americans, perhaps the most anxious and disappointed people on earth, for their nation infuses them with the most extreme hopes about what they may be able to achieve in their working lives and relationships. We are an optimistic people, and that's a good thing many times. But not always, because sometimes it creates unrealistic expectations. We put our faith in maybe in relationships with certain people, or in certain jobs we have, or in certain things we do, rather than in, you would say, in God. So this is an important theme, I think, to allow ourselves to not always wear the rose-colored glasses. Yes.
Is there a really good Orthodox book about pessimism that we can read to just get a realistic view of, I don't know, but my question makes any sense. But as you were reading that, I was like, how can we live in reality more and understand, like, things don't always pan out.
Well,
the way that, you know,
there's certain fathers that I think really excel at this. Well, no, Dostoevsky, as a writer, I mean, he really loved the dark side of human nature.
Okay.
I mean, he's really... read Crime and Punishment. Oh,
okay.
My gosh.
But it's not dark side. I don't know why. We've had this discussion before.
You,
I don't know
you
about, not? That, about pessimism and realism, right? I don't know why people call pessimistic people that just tell the truth and call it like it is. Everybody says, oh, you're such a pessimist. As soon as you say something that's just true and real...
Exactly.
So I think.
See,
I
so the irony is here, Alina.
Yeah.
In my family, I'm the optimist. But that's why.
I know that was the discussion about.
You're the pessimist. I'm the optimist in our respective marriages.
Yeah, with Tamara. Yes, exactly.
But I guess
I'm
admitting that you're right.
Again, I am not.
I'm admitting that you're right, though, because
I never put like the black whatever. I just see it as it
you
is.
See it as
call
it is.
It like it is.
You're not going to pretend that you... That, yeah.
I'm not going to pretend because that brings unhappiness.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes,
really,
I've never been disappointed once in my life.
Just keep the bar low and you'll always be
over. I need to be like that. I need to,
yeah,
I
just
need to become more pessimistic.
Just keep the bar here. There's nowhere to go from there.
We need to get together.
A couple other saints I think are good. Audrey, you asked what you
need. Yeah, I really do need to be more pessimistic.
A lot of Orthodox will critique someone like St. Dev and the Recluse for being kind of dark and dreary. I find him rather uplifting because he just kind of lays it all out there and says, you know, here's the task before you. Here are the tools you have before you. Try to make this work. And when you fail, you're going to fail, you know, but do the best you can.
Okay.
He's a classic example. St. Ignatius Brangenino, another saint that has a very kind of realistic view. Very kind of sober view of human nature. I think these are very useful, but if you read them as condemnation, it's very dangerous.
Right.
But if you read them as people who are just laying it out, who are kind of giving you this picture, and it's not condemning you, but it's just kind of telling you about human nature, it's very helpful.
Okay.
But if you read it the wrong way, it can be, I think, profoundly dangerous.
Well, I'll check in with authors. Right. Thank you.
I think humility and sobriety. Be a better way to put it than pessimism.
Exactly. I don't like that word. I don't know what you mean,
but... I agree. Sobriety would be our term for this. Absolutely.
And humility.
Yeah. And humility is a function, I think, of real sobriety, or sobriety is a function of humility. They work together, but...
I think of one of the Optina elders that said that the only way you could have peace is if you were humble. Mm-hmm. And I think that says it all. If you go around expecting things to be different than they are, then you're going to constantly be disappointed. But if you're humble and you just accept what comes to you from the hand of God, then you're going to constantly be perfectly pleased with what happens because it always comes from God.
Right. That's a good point.
That's from the secular point of view, humility is vice because it's humiliation. It's shameful to be humble. It's, you know, it's more honorable to be proud and to make your way and take your chin.
But I think that's a false
word
view.
It's raising you to believe, which is the biggest problem for all of us. And for me particularly, this has been one of the things I grew up thinking is a good thing, and I had a very hard time in many years to work over to try to put that down, because you grow up with that idea. So hard to get it off your hand.
I think we can bring it all together. The vision that he kind of concludes with, that I think is very appropriate for framing this, is the image of Job, right?
Right.
You know, Job, he is a man who has to confront his own mortality. And really, when we talk about pessimism or sobriety, it all comes back to this vision of, I am mortal, and I'm not God. And we have to recognize this, or we can't be, I would submit, we can't be Orthodox Christians, really, not truly in our hearts, but nor could we be healthy human beings if we don't have the vision of our own limitations. He says this about Job. Sitting in a pile of ashes, a broken man, Job scrapes at his skin with a shard of pottery. In terror and sorrow, he asks God why all these things have happened to him. Job's friends think they know the answer. He must have sinned. Bildad the Shuhite is certain that God could not have killed Job's children had they and Job himself not done something very wrong. God will not reject a righteous man, this friend tells Job. Zophar the Namathite goes so far as to hint that Job's crimes must have been terrible indeed, and God's generous in his treatment of him, because the Lord always forgives more than he punishes. Job dismisses these explanations, though, as nothing more than proverbs of ashes and defenses of clay. He knows that he has not sinned in the way they imagine. Why, then, has he been beset by these troubles? Why has God allowed his children to die and made him sick? Does God even exist? At last, after a good deal of further debate among the men, the Lord himself is prompted to answer Job. From a whirlwind in the desert, God thunders out, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words of knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding, by what way is a light parted, which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? Out of whose womb came thee, and out of came the ice and the hoary frost of heaven? Knowest thou the ordinance of heaven? Doth the hawk fly by thy wisdom? Canst thou draw out the Leviathan with a hook?" Job's direct challenge regarding God's existence and his ethical intentions is thus met with an indirect response from God, wherein God goes on at length, but how little humans know of anything. Fragile, limited creatures that they are, how can they understand the ways of God? God asks. And given their ignorance, what right do they have to use words such as undeserved and unmerited? There are untold things about the galaxy which mankind cannot properly interpret, and upon which, therefore, it ought not to presume to impose its flaw in logic. Human beings do not bring the cosmos into being. God tries to shake Job out of his preoccupation with the events of his life by drawing his attention to the immensity and variety of nature. He evokes a sweeping vision of the totality of existence, from the foundations of the earth to the tracks of constellations, from the heights attained by the hawk to the labor pains of a mountain goat, in the hope of instilling in the man from Uz a redeeming sense of awe before God. The strategy works. Job is reminded of the scale of all that surpasses him and of the age, the size, and mystery of space. God's whirlwind and the sonorous, sublime words he speaks excite a pleasing terror in his audience, a sense of how petty are man's disasters in comparison with the ways of eternity, leaving Job, and the rest of us perhaps, a little readier to bow to the incomprehensible and morally obscure tragedies that every life entails. It's beautiful, isn't it? God doesn't answer with an explanation. He answers the question, "Who are you? What do you know? Were you there when I made the earth? Were you there when I formed the goats in the heavens? You know, can you do these things?" And so, again, it's turning him back to a realistic vision of himself, right? Knowing his limitations, sobriety, a little pessimism, whatever you want to call it, but it's there. And it's very important. So, I want to sort of shift gears here a little bit and talk about, so we've talked about the human need to be realistic, the human need for tenderness. We also have a need for art and beauty. There's a quote from Dostoevsky that my wife had as her signature for years when we were in college. Dostoevsky says in the Brothers Karamazov, "Beauty will save the world." You know, that's a lovely quote. Beauty will save the world. De Botton suggests that this image of beauty has been a huge part of what it has meant to be human throughout our entire history. And what's happened, though, with secularism is that, and we talked about this last week, oftentimes literature has been used to replace scripture, right? Canons of literature have been used to replace scripture. At the same time, certain types of art and architecture have been used to replace church and spiritual life, etc. Churches, as kind of foci of meaning, have become replaced by museums and libraries and other things over the years. And it doesn't always work very well, he says. And I like how he reasons this. He says this. Hence the analogy so often is drawn. Our museums of art have become our new churches. The argument has an immediate and seductive plausibility to it. The similarities between churches and museums are there. Like churches, museums enjoy an unparalleled status. They're where we might take a group of visiting aliens to show them what we most value. Like churches, they're also the institutions to which the wealthy most readily donate their surplus money in the hope of cleansing themselves of whatever sins they may have racked up in the course of accumulating this money. Moreover, time spent in museums seem to confer some of the same psychological benefits that we might have at church. We experience feelings of communing with something beyond ourselves, of being separated from the compromised, profane nature of the world. We may even get a little bored sometimes, as we would in church. But we emerge with a sense that we have, in some kind of way, become slightly better people. Like universities, museums promise to fill the gaps left by the ebbing of faith. They too stand to give us meaning without superstition. Just as secular books hold out a hope that they can replace the Gospels, so museums sometimes may be able to take over the aesthetic responsibilities of churches. However beguiling this might sound, though, it suffers from some of the same flaws that bedevil the corresponding arguments about teaching culture within universities. Museums may, in theory, be well equipped to satisfy needs formally catered to by religion, but rather like universities, in practice they abdicate much of their potential through the way they handle the precious material entrusted to them. While exposing us to objects of importance, they nevertheless seem incapable of adequately linking these things to the needs of our souls. We are too often looking at the right pictures through the wrong frames. What he's saying is, when you go and you sort of look at art in museums, or when you kind of use literature and art as the standards for value, you have all these pieces. What do they mean? You know, how does the Brothers Karamazov speak next to Thomas Hardy's Return of the Native? How does the work of Rapin, Ilya Rapin, speak with the works of Monet? How do you get meaning from that can affect my life? And it's not at all clear. And in fact, that's the point of it. Really. There is no meaning to it. You get what you want from it. And there's nothing there that says to me, this is what you need to do. This is how you live your life. This is what will give your life direction and meaning. And in fact, it's not an accident that museums of art began in Paris, in the Louvre. You've heard of the Louvre before in Paris? That began, that was a palace that 3 days after the secular revolution of France in 1789, I believe it was converted into a museum. As they closed churches, they opened museums. I'm not saying museums are bad. I think museums are fantastic. But the point is, it was the idea was it would give meaning to this culture and to this experience. In Russia, there was a reverse experience, in a sense. There was a wonderful woman who did the icons over she had an icon clinic, Russian Orthodox woman who came to Asbury and did a seminar on icons. Her story is interesting because she was a non-believing Jew who studied icons in Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow, and she would study the layering of the paint. She was in charge of restoring them. And as she worked with them as art, she began to develop a love for what was behind them. And over a period of 15 years, as a state secular worker, she came to see them not as objects that had no meaning, but rather as incredibly meaningful objects that led her ultimately to Christ and to the church. She's now a pious Orthodox iconographer. But it's sort of the reverse thing that happened. She found the meaning in the art precisely by going to what they were supposed to do and what they mean. In the same gallery that she learned her discipline in, they keep the great Holy Trinity icon. Are you familiar with the icon of the Trinity? The Rubidov icon of the three angels? I don't have one in here. But that icon was kept there in the basement. She told me that she spent a lot of time with that icon. And in Russia, after communism ended, there were people that were down there every day trying to light candles in the museum. It was causing fire hazards. So finally, the church, they wanted it back. And the state agreed to not give it back to the church, but to build a church at the Tretyakov Gallery. And so now there's a church that is fully functional, that has this enormous kiosk, which is a big shrine kind of thing that the icon is set in, And you can walk through the museum and then take a little walkway, breezeway, into the church. And people are there praying. People are there just gawking at it. And there's a little lady who had the candles, and she's fixing the candles and putting up. It's a church. And every day they have a moleben before the icon. The priest comes in. They do liturgy periodically. So this icon is now back in the church. But it's kind of neat to see some of these things come full circle now in our day. But one of the most important things that Christian art does is it purposefully seeks out meaning in the materials. And in fact, it creates materials precisely to give meaning to our lives. For example, the classic example would be Christ suffering, right? Think of all the images in our liturgical tradition of Christ suffering on the cross, right? Or the icons related to his passion and his resurrection. Even icons like the St. Seraphim's favorite, which shows the Virgin Mary with the swords piercing her heart. It's kind of Catholic inspired. It's a beautiful icon. It's his favorite one. And you see these little swords piercing her heart, and she's holding her hands like this, pondering her son. But all these things are there to call us to something, to remind us of some important truth, and to encourage us in our faith. I'm going to read a little paragraph here about that. Christianity was never troubled by the notion of charging art with an educative or therapeutic mission. Its own art willingly aspired to the status of propaganda. Although the noun has become one of the most frightening in our lexicon, the word propaganda, colored by the sinister ends which certain historical regimes have put to work, propaganda is a neutral concept in its essence, suggesting merely influence rather than any particular direction for it. We may associate propaganda with corruption and tasteless posters, but Christianity took it to be synonymous with artistic enhancement of a receptivity to such qualities as modesty, friendship, and courage. So these things were incorporated into our vision, right? And art without meaning was somehow devoid of what it's supposed to do. And a word about suffering in Christian art. And it is fundamental to the power of the Christian story that Jesus died in more or less the greatest agony ever experienced by anyone. That's part of the story, you know. He thus offers all human beings, however racked by illness and grief, evidence that they are not alone in their condition, sparing them, if not the suffering itself, but at least the defeated feeling that they've been singled out for punishment. Jesus' story is a register of pain, betrayal, loneliness, self-doubt, torture, through which our own anguish can be mirrored and contextualized, and our impressions of its rarity are corrected. Such impressions are, of course, not hard to form, given how vigorously society waves away our difficulties and surrounds us with sentimental commercial images which menace us by seeming so far removed from our reality and their promises. So when we see Christ on the cross, when we see the images of the saints who are being martyred, what it does is it connects us to the fact that our lives, when we struggle and we suffer, the meaning with God is found in those moments. Because look here, on the cross, there's meaning. In the icon where the saint is losing his head, there's meaning. In the icon of the man being imprisoned, there's meaning. And so in those artistic pictures, we're invited to see our life differently. We're invited to rethink how we view the world. And this is a very key part of our faith in our pictorial tradition, our art tradition, here in our church. So I want to conclude here in the next couple minutes with some reflections also on another part of art, which is architecture. De Botton bemoans the depressing architecture of our time, and he writes the following about it as a meditation. To complain that a tower or motel offends the eye is not a category of distress that contemporary planners are skillful at honoring or addressing. Is that true? And its tolerance of landscapes generally leave us no option but to look at our feet. The modern world is resolutely, in a secular sense, Protestant. This is interesting here. Pay attention. It's good. When Protestant religion took hold in Northern Europe in the first half of the 16th century, it manifested an extreme hostility toward the visual arts, attacking Catholics for their complicated and richly decorated buildings. This is a quote from John Calvin. I shared this in my homily about a month ago, I think. For anyone to arrive at God, the Creator, he needs only Scripture as his guide and teacher, said John Calvin, giving voice to the anti-aesthetic sentiment of many of the new Protestant faiths. What mattered to Protestants was the written word. This, rather than art or architecture, would be enough to lead us to God. Devotion could be fostered by a Bible in a bare room just as well as it could in a beautiful cathedral. Indeed, there was a risk that through the sensory richness, sumptuous buildings could distract us, making us prefer beauty over holiness. It was no coincidence that Protestant reformers presided over repeated incidents of aesthetic desecration, during which statues were smashed, paintings burnt, and alabaster angels brutally separated from their wings. These same reformers, meanwhile, constrained their own architect to design sober and plain hangars, which could shelter the inhabitants of their congregation from the rain while they read the Bible, but would leave them undistracted by any thoughts of the building they were in. He's just describing the kind of approach that was had. One of the shocking things that I experienced when I went to, when I was in college, rather than go to Cancun with my other friends, I went with my other friends. One's at a friend of the Cancun, the other one went to England, and we took a history tour, and we went across to a lot of the old churches there. And what was so sad was how many of them had lost all kinds of. In England, you have these Gothic cathedrals with niches in the walls, and there, you'd see the bases of statues still there. A statue had been in the niche, but it was cracked and destroyed. You go into churches and you see the shrines, the saints, and there'd be a sign that said this was the reliquary of Saint so and so, but the reliquary was smashed and untended, left as it was when the reformers smashed it out in the year when was the Reformation? There, 1540s? Is that right, guy? Brian, 1540s? Is that when the Protestant Reformation took place? There, it was later. The English Reformation was later. That's about right. Anyway. But this was part of the experience there. And let me see here. That was a very depressing thing for me. I realized at that point that I would have to, if this was wrong, it had ramifications for my entire life that I couldn't ignore. Not coincidentally, surely, it was the Protestant countries in Europe which first witnessed the extremes of ugliness that would become so typical of the modern world. Manchester and Leeds and other cities in England, like them, subjected their inhabitants to hitherto unparalleled degrees of unsightliness, as if they were testing the full John Calvin contention that architecture and art have no role to play in the condition of our souls, and that a godly life can therefore be unfolded in a slum tenement with a view to an open cast coal mine, just so long as there's a Bible nearby. This ideology did not pass unchallenged. And the Catholic Church once again had a hand in resisting it. When the 19th century architect Augustus Pugin, a devout Catholic, considered the new landscapes of industrial England, he attacked them not merely for their appearance, but also for their power to destroy the human spirit. In two contrasting illustrations, he showed a typical English town, first as he imagined it had looked in the 15th century under a Catholic time, and then 4 centuries later, as it was in his day, grossly blighted by the oppressive workhouses, by mills and factories of Protestant origin. As Pugin saw it, Protestantism had directly promoted the reckless, hugely influential, and for developers, hugely convenient, notion that one might destroy his appearance without in any way damaging the souls of the people who live there. And that's a very, that idea, I think, exists even in our time, that, beauty is really a luxury, where in the Middle Ages, beauty wasn't a luxury, it was something that we all shared. And in fact, one of the ways you honor God was by adorning something. And there was an icon at the All-American Council this week. It's an old icon. And it's encrusted with all these people would give their jewelry and adorn it on the Riza. A Riza is is a metal kind of guard that goes around the image. Doesn't cover it, maybe cover part of it, but it's around like where you see the gold here. It covers that, and people would put jewels and chains and beautiful things and would adorn the image. And it was a way to celebrate beauty, right? So if God blesses you or you have a prayer request or something, you would do this act of beauty as a devotion to God. And in that, you would have this, well, it's an offering. God speaks of offering a lot in the scriptures. But beauty is certainly a part of that vision. So, for the Orthodox, good religious architecture does several things. It directs us to God with height, with orientation, with icons. It provides us a venue for gathering together with a particular purpose, that is prayer. And it challenges as well. Good architecture, not only is it beautiful and artistic, but it should challenge our egoism. It should challenge the fact that my belief that I'm the center of the universe. And whether it's a large church or a small church, good architecture, using light, using color, using spaces, works to kind of remind me that God is the center of the world, and I am not. In the West, they use the Gothic architecture to do that, right? This idea of height. You know, you walk into church and your eye goes up to heaven, and you recall that I am immortal. In the Orthodox Church, it was a different approach. It was a big dome, right? A big dome over the top. And you first come into the church, and it's a very low ceiling, so it's very tight. Walk in, it opens up, and you look up and you see Christ above you. And he's blessing you from the heights. Either way, one comes to realization that this is not about me. I am here and I am beloved by God, but he is God and I am not. It's like Job realizing who he is vis-a-vis God, right? It answers that question by asking another question. But art would do that too. Art brings us back to this idea of sobriety. And, you know, being realistic about our lives, taking us back to that point. So architecture and art and tenderness and sobriety and a healthy sense of realism, all this stuff is part of the human makeup of our lives that our faith reminds us of constantly. We can't avoid it. We can't get away from it. It's part of our life. And that's why it's important, I would submit to you, for us to be reasonably pious. If we're reasonably pious, if we're going to church, and we are kind of living our lives in the ways that our church has taught us, we're going to be facing these realities more and more, and we're going to say being drawn to God more regularly, more a part of our day-to-day life. So this is part of what the church gives us to do. This is why it's good to have icons at home. It's good to come to church and pray. It's good to go on pilgrimages. This morning I got to go to a church that's 106 years old. On the way out of the council ended last night, but I got to stop by St. Theodosius Cathedral and pray in a church that was built in 1906. And to be in that church with its height and its beauty was amazing, but even more amazing was to be in a place that had been prayed in for all those years too. You just walk in and it feels like this is a place that's dedicated to God, that people, grandparents and great-grandparents and relatives have prayed in for a century. And that's an awesome and incredible thing. And it's like the art and the faith and the scriptures and all these things come together in this experience, and we're invited into that. And our faith, this is part of what our faith is about. It's a way to live our life, a way to do the things that God is calling us. This is all for tonight. Next week, there's a break for Thanksgiving. And then last week will be my favorite topic, actually, the whole 5 weeks, entitled Institutions. What are they good for? So we'll leave it there. God bless you all.